This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on location, we're on remote, with two poets who are hilarious when they write together and unforgettable when they each write their own work. And you're going to hear it from each of them. Michael Gushue and Courtney Lance Bledsoe. Now, if you were in Australia, you'd say Bledsoe. But what do you say, Court?
Bledsoe.
That's right, Bledsoe. I thought you'd know. And so Michael is up first with an opening poem.
Oh, okay. So I'll read one of my own that will sort of lead us into how our collaborative poems kind of sound. This is called Hoover. Do you like the way I vacuum? I learned it on patrol in an unnamed Mideast country. You'd be gobsmacked at how hard it is to vacuum up an entire Mideast country. The logistics alone are a turtle's nightmare. We lost a lot of good soldiers in that campaign, although we didn't actually lose them. They mostly wandered away to bistros and ice cream parlors. Also, it wasn't really a Mideast country. It was New Jersey. I was just some kid with a vacuum cleaner and a dream, stars in my eyes, although I couldn't afford a vacuum cleaner on my pay as a busboy at a chain restaurant. I had to use a dustpan and a cooperative squirrel I befriended when I was living on a park bench. We would share acorns and work together to mug the small dogs people would leave unattended while they went and had sex in the bushes. It all went sour when I got a job as Mr. Peanut in front of the Planters Peanut Store on the boardwalk in Atlantic City. The squirrel tried to bury me for the winter. I'm done with squirrels, I told myself. But the emptiness inside could not be filled. I was a hollow canister, a shell, always hungry, always whirling, nothing but dust bunnies inside. That's why I like vacuuming so much. I'm not the loneliest machine in the world.
Oh, no, you are not. Michael, raise yourself up so that we can see more of you than that fabulous haircut. Thank you.
Is that better?
Yeah, that's perfect.
Okay, great.
You do very interesting things. First of all, I don't know how your mind works. Do you?
No idea.
We do know, but what I'm taken with is that you do a lot that Harriet Mullen does. And she won the Pulitzer Prize. I just want you to know. She takes the cultural icons that exist and she plugs in their unlike things, like analogies of the things. And that's what you do. You take things that we all know, ordinary things, and then you just change them so that it's necessary for us to have a common usage for your poems. But then you take them to an extraordinary scientific fiction place. So do you think you're up for the Pulitzer?
Yes.
Okay.
And let me say that Harriet Mullen, I am a huge squee fan of hers.
I can believe that because there's so much playfulness in you and wordplay, but so much which is political and very serious. And I'm on to you. I get all of
you. Yes, you are, Grace.
And Michael has been published in many journals, including the Indiana Review, Third Coast, Eunoia, Gargoyle, and American Letters and Commentary. He co-ran what's BAWA?
Oh, BAWA was the Brooklyn Artists and Writers Association.
Oh, that reading series. And then you did poetry at the Watergate.
Yes.
And you also run Nano Press 81 Names with Dan Vera. And he does a lot more that we're going to find out about. Some of it should not be said. But next to him is his buddy, Courtney Lance Bledsoe, he just makes me laugh every time I see him on Facebook. I just go on Facebook for him to say something about my cat. And so, Courtney, may we have the pleasure of your voice for public radio, for Apple, for iHeart, for Audible and Amazon Music?
Well, you asked so nicely, how can I refuse? I'm going to read a poem called Roaches, which is about rice farming. And I'm not going to explain too much because it would take forever. Roaches. When I was a boy, I heard roaches sing. It only happened at night after Mom got sick and went back to St. Louis. Dad worked long hours and stayed drunk. Every day I came in from the rice fields, too sweaty to sleep, but too tired not to. Pressed my cheek to the wall beside the bed because it was cool, and they were in there singing. This was different from in the fields. I'd heard mosquitoes, but never roaches sing. I'd felt water moccasins stroke my leg like fingers as they swam past. Felt the shovel dribble mud down my back like a heavy breeze. The dull gray levees that stretched out before me that day and would the next. Felt the weight of my father's tired muscles as we dragged him from his truck to bed. The quiet of the house since mom was gone. I forgot it all and listened to them sing. In the mornings I woke, staggered into the dusty light of my father's truck, and tucked the memory of my nights away under the hard slap of the sun on my back and the drunken jokes of farmers that didn't make any sense. I sank into the mud of those fields and into myself, waiting until night came when I could crawl into bed, press my face against the wall, and listen.
Only you can hear roaches sing, and I am just blown away by your work, Hard Slap of the Sun. You know, you are a genius. You are a genius, and I want everyone to know it. But this is funny because your resume, you give me a resume with like two lines. It says, raised on a rice and catfish farm in eastern Arkansas, C.L. Bledsoe is the author of 40 books, this is true, including the new poetry collection, Banana for Scale. There's another Harriet Mullen thing. And his latest novel, The Moon on My Back. He writes the humor blog, How to Even, with Michael Gushu, our other featured poet. You know, I have been following you for so long and you don't even know it. First of all, how did being raised on a catfish farm, I've never known anyone in my life, and I'm very old, I've met a lot of people. Never have I met anyone raised on a catfish farm and a rice farm too. How did that inform your writing? I mean, was it so boring that you became a creative machine, or was it so rich in a sensory world that you became filled with so many things you had to write every day?
Kind of both. My family are all storytellers. They're all big jokers, and all of our uncles and the people who worked on the farm, they would play practical jokes on each other all the time. You know, the fish shack is what we called where we sell the fish. You know, somebody might bring a guitar or a harmonica or something and play. They were playing practical jokes on each other in there too. Rice farming itself is very difficult. I didn't do it that long, but when I was a teenager, my father fired me actually, because he didn't want me to be a farmer. He wanted me to go out into the world.
That was good of him.
Well, he wasn't paying me.
Anyway, oh, he doubled your wages and he fired you. So that's where you get your humor, that Southern storytelling. Now, I have not read your novels. I intend to, but do they ever hark back to your country life?
Occasionally. Most of my novels are a little surreal. My newest, Happy Forever, is very strange. sort of post-apocalyptic, but
Man of Clay takes place in Arkansas.
Man of Clay does take place in Arkansas. Yeah, that's probably my best novel. It's about a golem that is bought by a plantation owner who's like a mad genius type, but he's not a nice guy, obviously.
A golem in Arkansas? It's such an anachronistic world. Now, here's your real resume. Bachelor of Arts with from the University of Arkansas. And you were the editor for Exposure. That was the literary and visual arts magazine.
I was one of many editors.
Oh, well, don't be modest. You were Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing from Hollins. Did you know Reed Whittemore there?
No, I didn't.
No, he was there. And you were assistant poetry editor and assistant editor for the Holland's Critic, which is a fabulous magazine. Mm-hmm. And then you co-founded, being tired of assistant editor, you wanted to be your own editor, and you founded Gotti Magazine. And
Fish.
You were the head editor there, right? Goti or Gotti?
Fish.
Ghoti. What does that mean?
Go ahead, Court.
It's a pun, like the
GH as in cough.
Yeah.
Oh, like that doesn't help me a bit, Michael.
Oh, as in women.
TI action.
If I were you, both of you, I would just stop where you are.
Yeah, I called it Goaty, even though it was I called it Goaty Fish, even though it was supposed to be a pun.
I think Goaty Fish works.
I liked it.
Yeah, I like it. And I like that you were the head editor. I like you to be ahead of everything.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. Not a problem. And since we have you here, let us have another poem.
Okay, I'm going to do one of the collaborative poems. This is called How to Lick a Thousand Stars. Start with a dependable work ethic. Sleep enough, but not to excess, lest you become lost in a dream. Stretching is important. Remember that butter is nature's way of saying you're too healthy. So slather it on at each meal, repeating the following phrase. Though they shot the shoe man, they won't shoot me. A man will come to your door claiming to be from the ministry. Do not believe him, no matter how well-groomed his nose hair. Instead, ask, why do the stars burn my tongue when all I want is to love them? This is love, the burning, he would say. Stars are always hungry, always eating themselves. They're just not that into you. But this is a lie. The truth is, there is no ministry, no stars. The shoe man survived. That'll be him now, knocking at your door, trying to wake you from his dream. He'll have every shoe you've ever imagined, but not in your size.
The stars are just not into you, Court?
They're just not into you.
That is just so sad. I mean, one would not expect that. But, you know, I don't want to hear about how you did it, because I'm going to exploit that to the max later. But I just have to, how do you do it? Just whose line was that? The stars are just not, you won't tell. You'll never tell, right?
I don't remember. Do you, Court?
Yeah, I don't remember.
I actually do remember. It was me. And I loved it. It was just such fun to work with you guys. Well, that is, you guys are just the Cheech and Chong of our time and little recognized. Now, let me see. What should we do next? Should we have another poem? Michael, let's have one.
Okay. Also from our collaborative, our new collaborative book, which I'm going to hold up.
Yay.
Which is...
Who did the cover?
Oh, well, the cover is by the remarkable and multi-talented Dan Vetta.
Yes, it is.
It is. So it's gorgeous.
I have a potholder made by him.
No kidding. Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah, he can do anything.
It's beautiful.
Okay, so this is from our collaborative book, Palace of Depression, Why I Want to French Kiss Salvador Dali. There's no shame in wanting to punch Salvador Dali in the face. Death is a nude woman. It offers many silly mustaches and rides an ostrich. A love of cauliflower, a trained ocelot. He's waving his giant loaf of bread at you. It's okay with him if you go all melty or wear a dress of mackerel with lobster epaulettes. Don't be surprised when he puts you up for auction. It's an art he excels at. André Breton facepalms himself every time Dali does another TV commercial for Wendy's or Buick or fascism.
There you go. You're out mulling. You're doing it again. I guess you won't tell me who said death is a woman, right?
Okay.
Yeah. I just...
People want to know that.
I know they do. Well, you can sell it. You could sell information and lie.
Yeah.
Well, why have you? I have been reading your episodic novel online, and it is, may I say, people would understand if I said it was unbelievable. So can you just summarize what you two did together, who the character was, and what you had happen? Just yes. Try in one sentence.
So it's the name of the book is Chip Andrews, Teen Exorcist. And we started with the title. And Chip is a young high schooler who feels a calling to be a demon hunter and exorcist. It's just, we're not sure where that came from, but that's what it was. He lives in a town in Michigan called Puddingville. And there is an incursion of demons into that small town. So he's fighting the demons, and he's fighting the even more evil forces behind the demons in the novel. He gathers a crew around him, his feisty younger sister, Kelly, his cousin, Mort, who has a interesting backstory, Morticia, whose real name is Betsy, and Marifer, who's a potential girlfriend. And they go up against the demons, they fight them. It's one in a we are actually planning a series of novels. We started working on the second one, and we'll see how far we go with it. So,
you two guys, don't you do anything else? This is amazing. But I don't read them online anymore. So have we stopped the first series?
So the first one is, I've taken it down from Substack, hoping to get some interest in publishing it. And I'm not sure. Yeah. Well, and we'll see what happens. Maybe we'll put the second one up when we get it further along. So that'll be Chip Andrews and the Night Spa. The Night Spa is like a day spa, except it's run by vampires.
Of course. And who would not want to go and get a rub down?
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
Oh, I just love you two guys. And so let me love you more, Michael, with a poem.
Oh, okay. This is January. We wrote a bunch of poems for each month, each season, each day. Some of them are in the book. January stumbles in with a pained whisper, hungover mornings and cold feet on hard wood. It's not the failure of good intentions we look forward to. It's the steady reminder of dust falling on the tongue. This year, I'm going to get in shape so I can break every heart that ever broke mine. Get rich and buy the bank that owns me. Find the volcano with the elevator that goes to the center of the earth where the giant ants live. They have the best coffee and sweet rolls. Everyone knows that. When the sky falls, it's easy to find malleable chickens under all the rubble and hope that they've learned something useful from the pressure. Until then, it's a matter of waiting for the splinters to attack when all the tweezers have gone dingo. What's that ahead? Hors d'oeuvres. Then jungle. Then more hors d'oeuvres. Then a rest area in the shape of a pumpkin that only sells plastic daffodils that smell like your mother before she died.
Oh.
At the door, the bouncer looks you up and down, shakes his head. The only reason they let you in is so they can kick you out between acts. Quotas must be met. Someone once told you there could be more than this, but you suspect they were just trying to get laid.
You're not supposed to laugh at your own work, Court.
Yeah, no.
He laughs at my parts.
Think of you being writers for somebody. I mean, just think of you in a writer's room. Everybody else wouldn't have a thing to say. You two are a writer's room. Court, okay, now the big deal. How do you do it? I can imagine many of things. Does somebody have an idea and then you riff on it? Does somebody do a skeletal and then somebody else fills it out? Does somebody do line and then an alternative line is yours? How in the world do you mesh the way you do? What is the, is it all of those things?
It is sometimes different things. Usually one of us has an idea and writes, you know, three or four lines or however many and sends it to the other. And then the other can do whatever they want with that. So if they want to erase some of it, or if they want to add to it, if they want to reorder it. I remember one poem, I can't remember the title, but I sent quite a few lines to Michael, and he just switched, he just reversed it. And that worked. That was good. And then added to it and everything. So there's no ego, really.
No, there cannot be.
Nope.
No. And no, actually, has there ever been any tension about anything?
No, I don't think so.
No, I can't remember any. No, we sort of agree when it's done, when it looks finished. We you know, we agree to the other person's changes for the most part. You know,
this is called a folie à deux.
Yes.
When you occupy the same psychosis. And so, and there's a French name for you guys. So how often do you get together, Court?
We actually meet at least once a week over something. Oh, not Zoom, but something else.
Google Meet.
Yeah, Google Meet. And we work on, usually we work on the novel. last night we met and worked on a children's book, like a picture book. Sometimes we meet twice a week, but usually just once.
Just once. And you've put out how many books together and novels?
3 books and 1 novel so far.
And is that including the online one?
That's the Chip book online. And then the other online stuff we did over on medium.com. So.
And not to count what you say on Facebook.
Yeah.
Which is immortal anyway.
Which cool. Is how we started. Yeah.
Oh, really? I had my cat was doing a backflip and I said on Facebook, who can do this? Can you do this? And Court says, if you can move him over, I'll give it a try. I mean, I can't even believe the things that are happening. Okay, the people don't care about that. So Court, the people do care about your poetry so that they will get enough of you as if we could. Let's have 2 in a row.
Okay. I'm going to continue with the month.
And what is the title of the book?
Oh, the title of the book is Palace of Depression.
And that's your new book, you two.
Yes, it's not quite out.
Oh, really?
We're waiting for some corrections and some distribution.
Well, this is a premiere, everybody.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is called February. February slides into the dinner booth across from you, uninvited. It lights a cigarette from a smoldering butt, takes a deep drag, blows a thundercloud towards the ceiling, and begins the monologue. This all happened a while ago. The wife was hitting the juice pretty damn hard, and I was too. I think it might have had something to do with how boredom traded pile drivers with hopelessness. Do you like that? It's from a script I'm working on for Scorsese. He just doesn't know it yet. I guess my Tinder date is held up in traffic. What are your desert island cheeses? Top 3. Don't say American or I'll murder your family with an air-filled syringe. I saw this guy do that on a Law and Order. The waiter circles the table for the 3rd or 5th time. There's no smoking allowed in here, sir. I'm not a sir, February says. I'm just a schmuck who hopes the next reboot will be worth it. The waiter leaves. I think this is going well, February says, right as the police walk up to the table. Okay.
February. Is that one of the ones where you wrote a poem for each month, each day, each minute?
Yeah.
Another one, Court. Let's have another one.
Okay, this one is my favorite in the book, for whatever reason. Droit de Seigneur. Every 8 months, this representative slogs from village to village, asking us how we rate the gods. We always say 5. The rep reports back to the gods, who nod sagely. They don't need to know. We realize it's not really swans winking at us when we go for water. Strangely warm mist copping fields by the berry patch. The crops won't come up unless we do a lot of slow bending to pick up prayer stones. The rains catch us in the fields and our lacy things every Tuesday at 3. We nod. We smile to stifle the yawns. There are 2 ways to keep the plague away. One is to bury our children in straw and paint happy faces on them. The other is to hold our hands in the fire until it's reassured that we think it's pretty.
That's my second favorite poem in the book.
Mine too. And only from you two could we have winking swans and singing roaches. It's so uplifting, you know, because we usually think of them as from central casting. Swans right. do their swan. But you two have given them a whole new character level, and I appreciate that. Nature appreciates that. And now, Michael, you are going to give us two poems.
Okay. How to Fold Laundry. Sometimes flooding the basement is the only way to save you from having to fold laundry. What they don't tell you about parenthood is the goddamn socks never end. This is not a metaphor for love, but it should be. Socks under the bed, socks behind the dryer gathering lint, socks named Cynthia I should have taken back to my hotel room that one night in Cleveland, if only I dared. Socks that should be in pairs, but are never found in the same place. There's only so much brokenness to fix any one house before you start looking for things to nudge off the edge. This is how a man lets grief in. By turning a screwdriver just enough to hold the pieces together and then fall apart.
That was profound.
Thank you. We were trying to pick these out. This is another month poem. I don't know how we ended up with that. So maybe they're the best ones. Mm. This is called June. So we're moving through the calendar. Mm-hmm. June, you're married to a tortoise. The tortoise has an affair with a rabbit. The rabbit's name is Achilles. That's when you realize you're trapped in a bridal magazine edited by André Breton. Every time you drop an egg on the floor, a justice of the peace comes down with the flu. Ceremonies that don't include Elvis are obsolete. He got halfway through the wedding vows, then one quarter of the way. Then 1/8 of the party got the fits and a 1/16th left to copyright their drinks. It's a kind of day sailing shoes seem like a good idea for walking a dry riverbed. André hands you the book of love, except it's made of feathers and eggshells. Make a nest from the pages anyway. Name each fold after something that's dead, a relative, an earthworm, an emotion. If you run out, you'll either have to start killing or found a church. André will forgive you as long as you don't turn a prophet and no one does the chicken dance.
You know, you are deep. Both of you are very deep because everyone knows that love is made of feathers and shells.
Yes.
That is the first time I've ever heard it defined accurately. And another one, Michael Gushue.
Oh, so that was another one?
How many have you read?
Two.
Well, that's quite enough for you.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask you a question, Michael.
Please.
This is it. Why is it so adventurous to be a writer? Now, that sounds stupid, but, you know, there isn't a more dangerous occupation. Like Outward Bound, my daughter went to Outward Bound. I said, honey, this is Inward Bound.
Yeah.
This is, what are the risks? What does it take? Why is it a big deal?
Well, I think you said, I mean, when you said Inward Bound, that's exactly right. I mean, if you take it seriously, and no one says you have to, but if you do, you have to constantly take that, you know, you're constantly walking off an edge of a cliff, hoping there's an invisible bridge there. So you have to keep, you know, for Cord and I, it's about, you know, let's not be comfortable. Let's set out for the wilderness each time. I think we're constantly pushing and that's both outward and going inward. You know, there's so much territory, there's so much unknown territory inside you to pull the curtain back on each time. And I don't think that ever ends. And that's always a challenge to, and the risk is to see if you can wrangle it into something that, you know, is beautiful and makes sense.
You know, you had a classical background. How did that, did you wind up the way you did? But you should have been a formalist, actually. How did knowledge of ancient Greece and antiquity find its way into these winking swans?
Well, I'm way too lazy to be a formalist. And also, I actually like playing tennis without a net. I think it's more challenging. Mm. You have to imagine the net at every point. So the college I went to, classical, but I mean, it's St. John's College, Annapolis. It's the Great Books program. So the first 2 years are, you know, Greek and Roman and early Christian and stuff like that. And you go through the canon of great books. And since the first ones you encounter are the classics, usually that, I mean, for people like I was, who had, you know, had read a lot, but certainly was not exposed to that kind of intense inundation of stuff, it makes a huge impact. So I'm always, in my head is always flipping through the index cards of classical things as whenever
you have written books using classical themes, which are very significant, very significant.
Yeah, I have. There's no direct connection. It had to all be digested, I think, for it to come out the way it came out. So, I'm always going back to those, beautiful books and ideas and images that come out of Greek writing and
yes,
you know, and another writing too. So yeah,
and also the pathos,
yes,
and humor, I think has its very deep roots.
Sure, and Aristophanes, yeah,
and your work, there's so much tragedy in it because it elevated from the depths of knowing otherwise.
Yeah.
What did you think you learned when you were a student of poetry? What do you think you took away from that? I mean, is it a good thing, master's degrees?
I didn't study poetry very much in grad school. I was focused on fiction and nonfiction and playwriting and things like that. This is going to reveal my arrogance, but I thought, well, I'm pretty good at poetry. So what I'm not good at is fiction.
Mm.
So that's what I studied for the most part. And, I took a couple of poetry classes, but, workshops and that kind of thing, but mostly fiction.
How about playwriting? Have you two together would be way off Broadway.
Yeah,
maybe in the Hudson Tunnel. But yeah. You two, have you ever thought of doing something on the stage?
We've written some plays.
Well,
they're more like radio plays.
Oh, well, let's look into that.
What'd you say, Court?
Yeah. Talking about the classical thing, they're set in ancient Greece, and they're about a pair of drunk, kind of useless reprobates who claim to be philosophers, but mostly just drink. So pretty much autobiographical for both of us.
Yeah, I get that. But were they waiting for something, these two, together? Waiting for anything?
Mostly trying to scam people.
I think we have to do that one. How long is it?
Oh, I don't have it handy.
You burned it. What? Do you have it?
We posted them on Medium. We wrote a whole series of them. Kind of like episodes of a radio play.
I have not seen that. What era was that?
That was a while ago.
Yeah.
5 years, maybe.
I'll check you out with that one. Give us two poems, Court.
Okay.
Court Bledsoe.
We write about squirrels quite a lot.
You do.
So this is called The Squirrel Saga. You wake up in a bed. Your stuffed squirrel is missing. You feel uncomfortably full. You wake in a boardroom at work. Bill is droning on about the new fiscal year budget. Past him, you can see a window, and out that window, a squirrel on a branch. It points at you and then draws one claw slowly across its throat. You wake in a hospital bed. The nurses are all squirrels. They squeak at you, and somehow you understand that there's been an accident. You fell asleep while driving, but that makes no sense because you rode the train to work today. You wake in an elevator. The door opens, and a squirrel orderly gets in. It looks at you. You must still be in the hospital. You push the top button because it's the first one you see. You wake on a roof surrounded by squirrel cops. If you step back, you'll fall off the edge. They advance. You wake in space, falling. You scream and look around. Several squirrels are falling all around you. They're wearing parachutes. You are not. You wake married to a squirrel. It wants an open relationship. You wake floating in a gray, featureless no place. Around you float innumerable squirrels in vertical and horizontal rows, reaching to infinity. They are rotating slowly as if on a spit. You wake living in a squirrelocracy. The Statue of Liberty is an enormous squirrel holding aloft a blazing acorn. You fall to your knees.
Do squirrels really? I do think they already have open relationships. I've seen them in my backyard. And one more from you, Court. It's from both of you. I understand that.
Listen carefully as our menu has changed. A man came to our door last night claiming to be from the gas company. We believed him. He immediately expanded to fill the doorway, an inflated uniform hanging above the threshold. The next day, it was a man from the electric company. Once in the living room, he exploded into lightning, left aurora borealis scars on the ceiling, our potatoes riddled with fulgurites. An albino milkman spilled onto our doorstep. Next to him, an iceman with a spiffy cap, frozen solid, waiting to shatter. We've been on hold with customer service for weeks. When they finally answer, we say, "Send everyone, please." At the corner, a circle of out-of-towners is blocking traffic. The shoeshine boy is tossing blazing sneakers into the sky to become stars.
Oh. Those same stars that are not into you.
Yeah.
You do it. Well, I think there's so much goodwill and happiness and love and fun in your work. I do want to say the albino milkman is profiling, but I don't want to, I didn't want to say anything, but I'm sure it will be fine because it's all done in goodwill. Your intentions are there. Nothing against milkmen. You know, you crack me up. I mean, I know that is just not the proper response to you. I should say something more elevated, but it's been a long time since I've laughed. Hours and hours. Michael, read us a final poem.
A final poem. You got it. This is the last poem in the book.
Which book?
The book, Palace of Depression,
forthcoming. Coming out soon.
Coming out very soon. And it's called How to Find True Love.
Of course.
Put your face to the moss on the forest floor and breathe in. Don't ask its name or what it thinks of you. Train the crows to gather shiny things that have starved to death. Then feed the ghosts the choicest bits of yourself. Eat every apple given, even when poisoned. The stomach is the quickest path to the heart and must be open. Listen to the wind with one ear, the crawling things with the other, but also learn to listen, not for your turn to talk. You can only find what you run away from. Therefore, make a nest of leaves and flower petals in a thorn bush. Everything you care about must lean into shattering, like ice too weak for your weight. We live where everything is burning to the ground all the time. Find what is not blazing, but glowing, and give it space to let its light reach you.
You should send that to the New Yorker, or if they would appreciate it. That is so sweet.
That's my favorite one.
It's beautiful. It's so sweet. Courtney Lance Bledsoe, give us a final poem.
Okay.
So when can people get The Palace of Depression?
It'll probably October.
Oh, this October is a debut.
November, so yeah, it depends on our, you know, production schedule.
And it's going to be on Amazon then, right?
It will be on Amazon and other places, yeah.
Okay, then let's hear it, Court.
Okay, it's hard to top that one.
Yeah.
This one is called Travel Plans. When it was time to migrate, the question of method arose. I wanted to hitch a ride on a tectonic plate, preferably ours. You looked forward to thousands of miles of air, surfing thermals from pole to pole. I admit I was lazy, content to move as fast as fingernails grow, so I could admire the changes in the apocalyptic scenery. I wanted to memorize each villain's face. That way I could recognize the redemptive arcs in the sequel. You said I was risk averse, afraid to take a step, letting the continent do the work for me. Maybe you were right. I couldn't blame you for wanting to soar, for liking that music all wind and light. But your nervous energy was hot oil spattering on a stovetop. I was getting burn marks. When I'd catch up during your daily nap, you'd ask what I thought I'd seen. Not a single cloud top, I bet, you'd say, and you were right. You were right.
The voice of Courtney Lance Bledsoe. And our guests were Michael Gushu, his collaborator. And this is the poet and the poem from the Library of Congress. We're on location, we're on remote with these two guys. And the program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turkin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the friends of the program, the Sinipet Fund, the Rivada Foundation of the Logan family, Natalie Canavore, Avi Deshashani, Young Ki Kim Renault, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and her engineer is Mike Turpin.